Thanks very much. Well, thank you, Professor Velo. Thank you, Francesco, if I may.
Thank you.
Also for inviting us into this splendid building, splendid hall. And I'm extremely grateful that we can talk about the European parties and their manifestos and the role of parties in European politics this morning here. If I was British or American, I would have to start this with an anecdote or a joke or something of that sort. Well, thank God I'm German. So all I have to come up with is a preliminary remark, eine Vorbemerkung, as we say. Now, my Vorbemerkung here refers to the times in the 1980s. Indeed, it's that long ago, when I was a student of political science, and I used to go to Poland, out of all places, which was still a communist country. And I had strong ties to the opposition, to put it that way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whenever they asked me, what do you study? And I answered, political science. There was an awkward moment. It was an awkward moment because in those days in Poland, it was by no means normal to study political science unless you were with the communist regime and wanted to become a journalist or something. But decent Poles, decent Polish intellectuals would study history or philosophy or maybe even natural sciences, but not political science. So, you know, in this awkward moment, the next question from the Poles always used to be, so do you want to become a politician? And that sometimes also had a pejorative connotation, you know, because politicians in Poland were communist politicians. So my answer, after a while, I had found out an answer how to overcome the awkwardness of that moment by saying, look, a biologist doesn't want to become a frog, right? And this morning, sitting here, I feel a little bit like the frog.
Okay.
Especially after having heard the speeches that led up to this panel here. Having said that, I can be very quick on the content and the method of the manifesto. And really, I won't bore you. It's not an empty promise. And I think I would like to formulate a couple of theses at the end as an answer to your questions and also to the presentations we've heard this morning. So, about the manifesto, well, in fact, in the conference materials, you will find two documents from the European People's Party. One is the manifesto, which is really the compressed, short version, which even contains an even shorter summary of the content, which is actually spread out in front of your eyes and takes about a couple of hours to read, not counting the power naps in between, of the action program. And the action program is the one that went through all formal stages of approval in the party structure. So the action program, which has 35 or 40 pages or something, the action program was initially formulated by what we call Working Group 1 of the party. And Working Group 1 is basically composed of three groups of people. These are the national, the international secretaries of the national member parties or other delegates from the national member parties. That is people from the EPP group in the European Parliament, and that is, of course, in the driver's seat, if you want, of this whole process, the Secretariat of the EPP, with some contribution from the Martin Center for European Studies. And within that working group, there was a small committee of people that made the first draft. I was one of those. And then things took their own course, and you had several rounds of amendments that were approved or disapproved by all the others, and you had a truly democratic process of the participants within Working Group 1 until we had a first consolidated draft that could be presented to the Political Assembly, which is a joint institution of the
EPP as a party and the EPP group in the European Parliament, again with many delegates from the member parties. And then it goes, and then it went to approval, the last formal approval at the EPP Congress in Dublin on 5th and 6th of March this year, where also we nominated our top candidate. So that was the formal part. Now, the manifesto, this with the 12 points, which I'm going to summarize in a second, the manifesto is like a short version of that action program. And the manifesto, for the sake of readability and for the sake of clarity and some kind of unity in style, did not undergo this formalized, highly formalized process with inputs from many sides, which usually serves to improve the contents, but also make the language a lot worse. So the manifesto is like a summary of the action program. And the manifesto, now let me get to the content, has these 12 points. It starts with a positioning of our political party family vis-a-vis others, making reference to central values that we're based on. It then goes to talk about what kind of Europe we want. First in very general terms, then being more specific in three areas, and that's economics, or economic and social affairs, European social market economy, to combine the principles of freedom and solidarity, but also with a central postulate about from reform to growth. I would put it into these words, and that's also the hashtag that is very often used in our political family, from reform to growth, with a two as a number two, very cool. This from reform to growth really encapsulates what we believe in, which is that there is not a simple alternative between so-called austerity and growth, but that actually fiscal consolidation plus reform will actually lead to a situation which enables us to create sustainable growth that creates jobs. So there is a sequence, not an alternative either or, it's one is the precondition for the other. And we believe that this is the element that distinguishes our political family in this sector of European politics from other political families. It's from reform to growth. Next, we talk about domestic justice and home affairs, which means immigration from outside the European Union, mobility within the European Union, both of which are things that we need, both of which are things that are part and parcel of our presence and our future. And both of which, however, need to be dealt with in a manner which is in accordance with the treaties, but also in accordance with the interests of the citizens. We're absolutely aware that, well, as Jean-Claude Juncker put it in one TV debate recently, the EU cannot take in all the misery of the world. This is not the function of the European Union. The EU has to take in people who are refugees from political oppression or war. But there has to be some kind of balance between the interests of our citizens and the wider principles of the international community. And within the European Union, it's absolutely clear that mobility is a basic right, is a fundamental right. And if there is any abuse, which is picked up now by populist parties within that system, it has to be dealt with within the existing legal framework. No new legislation or strategy on the European level is necessary on that. And finally, the third sector of our manifesto refers to foreign and security policy, especially focusing on the spreading of democracy and stability and the rule of law in our neighbourhood, in the south and in the east. And we see now in Ukraine how necessary it is to shape up on this and to be more efficient than we all have been in the past couple of decades. And also, of course, to continue to work on a trustful transatlantic relationship. And I think there's a very strong correlation between these two points because, you know, we are going to lose business in the East, whether we want it or not. Sanctions or not, Russia itself is isolating itself from the world. Russia is economically nosediving at the moment. We will lose trade in the East, which means very clearly that we have to gain some elsewhere in the world, and the obvious area, the obvious direction in which we can improve on trade and investment is the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which is a great project which needs to be, of course, balanced with the interests of citizens, of consumers, of workers. But in the end, we will have to make up for the lost business in the East by improving the transatlantic economic relationship. And these are selectively, the central points of our manifesto and the central points of our action program. And let me now come to conclude with a couple of theses as a response to the very interesting and inspiring ideas we've heard this morning. Three points on why I believe that European-level parties have become more important over the last 10, 20 years, especially 10 years. Formally speaking, of course, the financing of political parties from the parliamentary budget since the Treaty of Nice was a decisive step. That's number one. But number two, and more importantly, I think, at least for the EPP political family, is the fact that the EPP as a party has been not only the organizer, but also to a certain extent the agenda setter of what we call the pre-summits. You know, the meeting of the heads of state and government from the EPP political family before a European summit, where very crucial pre-decisions are taken, policies are coordinated, strategies are hatched out to actually address the questions that are then formally addressed in the meeting of the whole European Union a couple of hours later. Now that, of course, works only in a political family in which you have a certain number of heads of government. But I think the EPP has used that very well, especially since this does not only refer to the heads of state and government level, but also to the ministerial level. There are by now, I think, about 8 ministerial pre-council meetings within the EPP context, which greatly increases the role of the European level party. Now, it doesn't mean that it dictates anything to these people. And yes, in many cases, the prime responsibility of the party here is the technical arrangement of the meeting, you know, renting the place, getting the infrastructure right, and so on. But yes, there is an amount of agenda setting, also on the ministerial level, and coordination with the national member parties and the national governments, in fact. Well, and the third point is obvious, and it's been mentioned this morning, the decision by almost all the political families on the European level to field top candidates for the Commission President in these elections. And I think that is probably the most visible element to the public of the increased role of the European parties. And we're going to talk a lot about this later on, I'm sure. I don't want to go into detail here. But let me now just enumerate three reasons why I think it is not a foregone conclusion that we're moving to a national party system. And again, this has been mentioned by our speakers this morning, Professor Rondo, Professor Masha. I think that, first of all, we can all agree that as we speak, there is no European demos yet. There is not one European electorate that perceives of itself as such. And the euro crisis indeed has moved things in this context and has arguably increased the awareness of the interdependence And in that sense, you could say that we've come closer than ever before to European demos. But lo and behold, there has also been a paradoxical effect that this awareness of our interdependence has created, at least temporarily, new animosities, new antagonisms between the nations of Europe, some nations of Europe. If I look at Più Italia, meno Germania, it's one of these examples, right? So, you know, it's no foregone conclusion that this European economic crisis has necessarily and unequivocally brought us closer to a European demos. Second point, the rise of populism. Woo, barbarians at the gates. I tell you, my prediction for the 26th of May is that, first of all the mainstream political parties are going to scream and shout that now we have to close ranks and face the new populism from the left, but especially from the right, and the new nationalism shoulder to shoulder as a unified front. Well, that's exactly what they want. That's exactly what they're waiting for. Because if we make this an election about, are you for or against Europe? And if we make the next 5 years, if we create the main paradigm around that question, well, great. Mr. Wilders and Madame Le Pen, they're going to be only too happy to tell their people, look, these ladies and gentlemen on Berlaymont Hill, they can paint their faces red, black, green or yellow, but they all want the same thing. More Europe, less power for the citizens, and they are unified as one bureaucratic Brussels elite. Well, let's not behave like that. Let's emphasize the differences, you know, while of course recognizing what we have in common among the mainstream political parties. But let's not do them the favor of falling into the trap and behaving like one Brussels elite that all want the same for Europe. And the third point, indeed, there are systemic limits in the treaties to make this even remotely close to a national democracy. And we all know that. The European Parliament is not like a national parliament. The European Council is not like the second chamber of a Senate, a second chamber of Parliament like a Senate. And the European Commission is not a government. So, you know, yes, the Lisbon Treaty contains some elements which push the system a couple of centimeters further towards a national-style democracy. But I tell you, let's have no illusion. We are still far away from that. And in that sense, we should take the postulate that citizens of Europe can influence the future course of the European Commission by voting in a certain way, this way or that way, in the European elections with one tiny grain of salt. Just, you know, it is important. And it is bringing us closer than ever to a true European party system. I absolutely agree. But we're far from the status quo of a national political party system. And we should sometimes not suggest to our citizens that we're already there or we're even close to that kind of party system, which indeed requires an opposition and a government and a true parliament and a true government and a coalition, a majority, a minority, and all these things. So I don't even need 5 minutes. Thank you. I'm already done. These were just a few remarks from the frog's perspective.
Perfect.
On the indeed important question of the European parties and their future role. Thank you.